The leader of the top party. It's always a hard one, Raf, the top party. It's like the ASB Bank, the Auckland Savings Bank Bank. So it's either top, the Opportunities Party, or the Opportunities Party. So do you call it the top party or just top?
I think you either call it top or the Opportunities Party.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. So the leader of top is Raf Manji. And joining me to have a chat in the Department of Conversation. Thank you very much for joining me. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Good. Thanks for having me.
Look, a bit of a mea culpa, or a bit of a, I'm being honest and open with you at the start, is I had, I do another show where we do evening live stream broadcast talking about the news of the day. And there was a poll the other day that came out, and it listed all the, you know, all the parties where they're at, and it kind of finished off on top, and it said, you know, top is the highest of the miners. We're going to stop at this, and we're going to not talk about the other parties. So that's basically what I think it might have been TVNZ said. Okay. And I was talking about it that night, and I was like, oh, we don't really need to worry about top because they're not going to be there. And then someone in my comments, because we live stream, said, what about Elim? What about if Raf wins Elim? Then they may be there. And I thought it's probably beholden on me to actually not sort of make that public statement quite so absolute, because there are some variants as to how this could happen that could see you guys there at the end. So I thought the best way to do it is just to get you on, have a chat, and find out a bit more about top and about you yourself.
Yep, that's a very good idea, I think, because anything could happen in this election, I think.
Yeah, well, why don't you tell us a bit about you personally? Now, I know that you're born in the UK. I know that you've come across here, but I don't know really, like, someone made a joke to me yesterday about Christopher Luxon and said, oh, have you heard that Christopher Luxon used to run an airline? He doesn't talk about it very much, but are you aware that that used to be something he did? So give us a bit of the synopsis about you and life before politics. Who are you? Who were you? What did you do? You know, I don't want to quite say what are your credentials to be a parliamentarian, because there are none, but, you know, what would make you a good parliamentarian?
Yeah, no, good question. And look, thanks for having me on. Yeah, so I was born in London. I'm 56, so I've been around a while. And I think I'd probably look at my sort of career progression and life progression in those different sort of decades, if you like, after leaving school. So I went to school primarily in London, and went to university in Manchester, studied economics and social studies. And then I went on my big OE, which I was away for nearly 2 years, actually. Traveling mainly in Asia, and bumped into a Kiwi girl down there, and sort of hooked up, and ended up down in New Zealand in 88. Did a bit of traveling, backpacked around the South Island, and just, you know, absolutely fell in love with the place. I just thought it was quite an incredible spot. It was before the days of 24-hour opening, so everything used to shut. I remember hitchhiking to Dunedin on a Saturday lunchtime and thinking, oh, this looks cool, and then all the shops shut, and I'm going, what happened to, you know, where's everyone gone? So it was a bit weird. And then 2 years later, everything was almost reversed, we ended up going back to London, and I got a job in the financial markets, and essentially worked in investment banking for the next 11 years, primarily trading global markets, a bit of risk management in the early days. And I traded mainly, you know, global, what we call G7, so the main currency and bond markets for primarily, yeah, investment banks. And it was, you know, I mean, I quite enjoyed it. I've always had a bit of a love of gambling. Used to, get onto the horses and play cards when I was at university, and, you know, loved that. So, yeah, so risk, right. Risk taking, risk management, risk analysis has always been something I'd love to do. And then probably towards the end of the 90s, we'd had a couple of kids, and we were thinking, look, where do we want to settle down? Is it London? Is it Christchurch, which is where my wife was from? And right. After 9/11, I'd actually left the financial markets, and I was working for an environmental startup, actually, called Trucost, which is still going. It's now called Sustainable One. It was bought by Dow Jones a while ago. And it was actually 9/11 kind of triggered us to say, I just said, right, let's get out of here. And we moved to Christchurch in 2002. And then I probably had my sort of, let's say, second career, which was, you know, the mythical balanced life. You know, took the kids to school, went back to university, did a lot of nonprofit work. I worked with budget services, children of prisoners, refugee resettlement services. So it couldn't have been further away from the job I was doing in London in the 90s.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did sports coaching at school and, you know, a lot of other nonprofit work and really enjoyed it. And it was quite a nice time. And then in the 2010s, we had the big earthquakes in Christchurch. And that obviously changed a lot for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I got involved after that because I was in the nonprofit space. I got involved with the Student Volunteer Army and chaired that for the first 2 to 3 years and kind of, you know, took the legacy of their response after the earthquakes in Christchurch to say, okay, how can we develop this into something that's long lasting? And when you look at the SVA now in Auckland and in Otago and at Vic and the work they did through COVID and the work they've done post-flooding, shows that we were able to kind of keep the legacy of the Christchurch response going. And then through that, you know, I bumped into, you know, people like Leanne Dalzell, who was thinking about running for mayor in Christchurch in 2013. And she said, look, would you consider standing for local government? And I kind of said, oh, I don't really know much about it, to be honest. But she said, look, I need somebody with a finance background. It's got a lot of financial problems. And I was just actually finishing a master's I was doing in international law and politics. And so, you know, the timing was right. And I thought, okay, it's, you know, we all need to kind of contribute here. So I stood and got elected, which a lot of people were quite surprised about, that I could get elected, having never been a community board member or councillor or been involved in politics at all. But I had deep roots in the community, which is in Ireland. And that helped me get across the line. And yeah, spent the next 6 years dealing with some very complicated financial challenges that the city faced post-earthquakes. And look, it was an interesting time. It, you know, I found the politics of it quite difficult at times because I'm a fairly, you know, non-partisan person, very sort of focused on solving problems and outcomes. Even though, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you're a bit of a greenie. And then they go, oh, no, you're a bit of a market guy. And I'm going, and then you do all this social work. I go, yep, that's fine. What's wrong with that? I'm a balanced, I have a balanced approach to things.
Yeah, yeah.
And then just as I was leaving council in 2019, we had the 15th of March attack. And I got pulled into that. My father was a Muslim. He died last year. And so I knew the culture pretty well, even though I'm not a practicing Muslim myself. And so I was asked to do various things, but I ended up doing managing the money, all the donations that had been received. And
I read
a report for the government on recommendations in terms of handling the response to the community. And then I sort of, yeah, became a community advocate for the next 18 months after I left council. And then that was pretty hard work, actually. In fact, the 2010s, that decade was pretty tough all round. And then I had, in a way, a little bit of time off, went up to Wellington, did some consulting work for the Human Rights Commission and the police. And, yeah, just as I was thinking about doing a PhD, the top called me up, Jeff Simmons, and said, oh, would you have any interest in taking over the leadership? And I kind of said, no, I don't want to get back into politics. Thank you very much. But in the end, I think, and I think this speaks to why I'm here, is I just think that we're at a huge tipping point and that we do need to make some changes. We do need a little bit of vision. We need some policies that are focused on the future. And I just think the experience I've had over the last, you know, essentially 40 years is very helpful. I've been in politics, so I understand it. I know how central government works. I'm pretty well connected to the community here. And I think it's worth doing. And I know it's difficult. I know an MP is a problem, but I just felt that whatever happens, our voice needed to be in the conversation because there's nothing going on. No one's talking about anything really. So, you know, it is hard work. But I think we're starting to get a bit of traction and we're starting to put out some interesting policy. And hopefully as we get towards the election, there will be more conversations about stuff that really matters. So that's kind of me. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty good nutshell. I appreciate that. You just said towards the end there, because MMP is a problem. Why is MMP a problem in your opinion?
The 5% threshold. it's a barrier to entry for fresh ideas. That's simply it. It's too high. And what it means is the whole point of MMP was that you had more, you know, coalition style, you know, European style government, maybe more collaboration, but also you had the ability for new parties to come in and out. But the way it's
so you're purely talking about the 5%. So in other words, we've had commissions and things looking into this. If you were to write MMP, like if it was a 2% entry point, you'd be like, MMP is fine. But that's literally just the entry point.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, because I think if you work it well, I think you can get good results. But I think the way it's working at the moment, it's causing an embedded status quo and a kind of stasis. And obviously, a majority government has shown that is not really what we want these days. We do need people talking to each other. And they do. I mean, there are plenty of people in Parliament who are happy to talk to people from other parties, but they're kind of constrained in how they can actually do that.
Where would you put the threshold if you were to be able to select it for yourself? Like, it's currently 5%. Where would you want to see it?
I mean, probably 3%, I think is fair.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, because if it was 3%, still.
If it was 100,000
people, give or take.
Is Top getting there on 3% if it was that?
If the threshold was 3%, we'd be there without a doubt, because the number of people who go, oh, I'd support you, but it's a wasted vote.
Completely. 100%. 100%. And look, listening to your sort of bio, your synopsized bio there as well, like you say, there's elements of way left and there's elements of maybe more conservative or centre-right sort of thing. So I'm just going to bring up, this is like the official political compass, yeah? Politicalcompass.org, and this is the last election. You guys aren't on it. Where would Top put themselves on this based on your sort of ideologies, your policies maybe in more particular? Where would Top be on this compass between libertarian, authoritarian, left and right?
Well, we'd certainly be south. We'd be, I mean, some people actually say we're kind of the love child of the Greens and the ACT Party. And in fact, funnily enough, I'd say we'd be slightly to the left. Yeah. So I'd say we'd be down the edge. We'd be about that, I'd say. Yeah, probably just to the right. We'd probably be where the Greens are, but slightly to the right of the middle,
right,
the middle scale.
Sort of thing. So that's sort of mirroring the Green, but on the down the libertarian side, but on the center right side. And is that mostly because of policy that you end up there, or is that because of like social beliefs, or what would put you on the slightly right of politics as opposed to somewhere else?
I mean, it's not right really. That's on the economic stuff, I think.
For sure.
We're definitely, yeah. So progressively, I mean, we're very liberal. I think the way we approach things is probably a big thing. So I'm comfortable talking about financial markets. That's the world that I'm from.
Yep.
I understand how financial markets work. And sometimes people think that means that somehow you're center-right or conservative. It's not. I'm actually super liberal, you know. And I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. When I was working in London, I was sitting on the trading floor, and behind, this was probably 98, I think, and I had a poster of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on the wall behind my seat. And I had some colleagues over from the States, and they looked at it and went, Rafi, you're a communist or something. it's like, no, I just care about people. And it's like, oh, you know, so the idea that you can't be interested in a capitalist structure if it works properly for the people. Now, the fact is, we don't have a system that works like that. So that's why I ended up working in a company called Trucost, because it was like, actually, if we have the true cost of things, we'll probably make better decisions. So I think that's why people go, oh, you know, national light. Well, it's not anything. It's basically a progressive liberal view, which is more probably a classical liberal view, more like the Scottish Enlightenment of the sort of, you know, 1800s, where when people quote someone like Adam Smith and the essentially the inquiry into the causes of the wealth of nations, which was the title of the book. Before that, he wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. I mean, he was very focused around the morality of markets. And I think because so many people don't understand how markets work, or even how money works, or even how the banking system works, as we've seen recently, it's very difficult to talk about it without being portrayed as somebody who is just from that end of town.
Yeah.
And I think probably the last 25 years, this is the issue that has kind of interested me the most, which is actually, how do we build a more sustainable society? And it does involve, you know, environmental issues and social issues and financial issues, but you have to get them all right. And I think in terms of Top, and its approach, because it does focus probably more on the problems and the policies that might solve them, yeah, we're regarded as a bit nerdy. And I think, you know, definitely Gareth was pretty hardcore around this stuff. But I think, you know, having worked in the social services sector, yeah. I have a pretty good idea of, you know, what life is like down there. And that's kind of my approach. So, yes, I'd say, you know, I voted Green for a long time. In 2002, and this is the MMP thing, so I'd arrived here from the UK, you know, voted for Tony Blair and what have you. And, yeah, I'd never voted the Tories at all and yeah. never would. But we had an election in 2002. I didn't really know much about MMP. And I voted ACT and Green in that election. Which probably tells you a little bit about kind of a liberal approach to things, but with the environment absolutely at the core. And I think that's kind of, you know, so that's where all the blue green and all the teal stuff, I guess, comes from. And I'm kind of comfortable in both areas in a way, but I'm just not tribal.
Speaking of blue green, looking at your you know, your actual branding, if I bring up your homepage, is that actually any of the reason? Look, the O in the top is pretty much that teal sort of color. It seems to be what you are.
No.
Are you actively saying we're the blue green?
I think, well, we're saying we're the teal party. Now, in a way, we looked at rebranding last year to the teals, but it was too expensive. So we just thought we don't have any money. So it's a waste of money. But I think, and I'm colorblind, so I can't even tell you what color that is anyway. So it's terrible. I mean,
what a lefty thing to say. I don't see color. I don't see color. No, very good.
Well, actually, I can't, I don't. I mean, I grew up in London. It's, you know, so I'm kind of, I am reasonably colorblind in that respect. But I think, yeah, it's, I love the color. I mean, our branding team's done a fantastic job in creating, I can see, oh, that's a beautiful color. Yeah, that's about it.
You're talking about money. I've spoken to Gareth Morgan. I've had him on this podcast before, and we talked a bit about TOP. And I also have done a little bit of reading. It seems that he left in a interesting way. Like, I've talked to him about commenting on other things as well. He's like, I don't talk politics anymore. He goes, once I left it, I don't do it. I'm not interested. I'm not going to do it. Is there still a relationship with Gareth and you guys? Because it seems like he pulled the rug out. It was like, I'm canceling the party. There's no chance for them in 2020. And then there was a bit of backroom conversation. Some people wanted it. So he pulled back on that. And then he said he'd still support some of the candidates if they had kind of, you know, the ideology of TOP that he started with. Is there anything, I'm not even saying, are you affiliated with him, but is it still a good relationship with Gareth? Because he's the founder. Yeah. Is there still a good relationship with him there? Is there still, like, you know, are you kind of behind closed doors still mates with Gareth Morgan? Is TOP still mates with him?
Look, you know, I didn't really pay any attention to the kind of the history in terms of, you know, I knew what had happened in 2018 and Gareth had, yeah, said, right, I'm done, shut the thing down. And they decided to keep going because there was a bit of money left. And when I took it on, it was like, okay, we're starting from scratch, essentially.
Right.
And that's how I've approached it. Now, I mean, I do know Gareth personally, and I bumped into him a few times. Walking around, you know, Oriental Parade, which is where he lives. And, you know, it's quite funny. We actually exchange, you know, a conversation, but we don't talk about politics at all. So, right. Yeah. So, and I think that's a fair enough thing to do. Politics is a tough, tough business. And I think when someone leaves it, you kind of think, okay, you've done your dash. Now you can be a kind of private citizen again. And I think that's kind of important. So I'm aware of his views. And, you know, I think I've just sort of decided to leave it alone. If Gareth was of a mind to, you know, support us or whatever, he would get in touch. He's not the sort of guy. Right. He's not shy about that stuff. But he's busy doing his other stuff. He's got the golf course. And I think that's great. He had a really big go. We know what happened in 2017 and what could have been. And whatever happens, he'll always be known as the founder of the party. And I think that's something that we always need to acknowledge.
Yeah. You talked about kind of politicians just talking. My paraphrase of what you said, just talking and not saying very much. I want to ask you specifically, as we're recording this, there's just been an announcement made by the National Party and Christopher Luxon. I don't know, because this announcement was only made in the last hour as we're recording this, so I don't know how much of this you're actually across, Rafe, but the idea that National was going to rewrite the curriculum, and then they took a step backwards and they said rewrite sort of reading, math, science and writing curriculum. I'm going to read this out to you in case you haven't heard it all yet, also so I can then ask you a question about, are they just... Is this just more talk, or is there something here, and is this something that Top would agree with? National leader Christopher Luxon has unveiled the details of their four-part plan to improve literacy and numeracy in the primary school curriculum. He said the party would set a target of 80% of students at or above the expected curriculum level for their age by 2030, with New Zealand in the top 10 in the world in PISA rankings for maths, reading and science by 2033. Luxon told media this afternoon his party would chart a, quote, positive course for New Zealand that's not about left or right, but about going forward instead of backwards, and it's about delivering results and outcomes, end quote. He said it would do this with its Teaching the Basics Brilliantly plan. The policy involves children spending an hour on average per day on reading, writing and maths, similar to the Back on Track policy announced in 2021. It would shift the curriculum from 2 to 3 year bands of requirements to year specific. The plan would also involve standardized, robust, twice a year testing of reading, writing and maths ability from year 3 to year 8, with detailed reports for parents. Now, I had a principals association principal on last night on my daily show, and we had a good chat about the idea of this. But before I kind of give you anything that we've been thinking about, what are your initial thoughts as to what National is proposing in this? And do you think this is politicians talking, or is there some meat on these bones?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's hard to say. I mean, we actually have a very good education spokesperson, and I would absolutely refer to her around this, and she's done a lot of work on this issue. Education is not my kind of core expertise area. I think, you know, but I mean, I've had two kids through school. I kind of know both who had learning issues. Look, I think we want to have great educational outcomes for our children. And I kind of think we seem to be struggling a little bit. And I think some of the problems are, yes, maybe around expectations. Not paying teachers enough is another issue. So they can't actually focus on the teaching. They have to do too many other things. The social determinants of education. We talk a lot about the social determinants of health. The social determinants of education are also critical in terms of kids getting to school well-fed, kids being in a safe environment at home so that they can learn. And I mean, I've experienced this firsthand in some of the places I've worked, that sometimes you get massive improvements in outcomes for kids when you sort out the home life. Then they can actually read and pay attention, kids with learning difficulties. So it's a pretty complex business, but I think from what I understand, you know, the focus of National is to get more focus back on standards. I think Labour had removed those standards. So yeah, I'd have to have a look at it in more detail and talk to the team about it. But I think there's a lot of concern about educational outcomes. But I think a lot of them are also, relevant to the broader issues around poverty, poor housing, and you know, lack of community support. So yeah. The kids that get to school with the right clothes, the right food inside them, they start ahead immediately. Forget about kids who are going to private schools or things like that. So there are bigger issues to solve here. And obviously education at the other end is changing. I mean, the stuff that is available online, the university model is under huge pressure, and whether that tertiary model is going to stand up to the technological innovations that are coming in terms of AI and ChatGPT and whatever else is available, the amount of information that is available online is incredible. And just also the opening up of educational support from around the world. I was saw the example of a guy who wanted to get some tutors for his kids around maths, actually. Right. And he was able to hire a PhD mathematician from, I think, Pakistan for $4 an hour to tutor his kids. Yeah, because this is the online gig economy. You can pretty much get. And what it does, so it's a win for the person coming from a country where their pay is very poor. And it's a win because you're getting a kind of basically PhD lecturer in maths to tutor your kids, which is probably overkill a little bit. But this is, you know, there are a lot of other challenges here. And I think there's a lot of issues to fix. And if you think about school is where a lot of our children spend a lot of their time during the day. And the impact of home life on that and the relationship with school is pretty critical. I think we all want good outcomes for our kids, and we should be able to sit down and kind of talk about what is the best way to deliver that. And, you know, obviously I'll have a closer look at the national policy, but there's definitely some concern out there.
Yeah, I thank you for sharing. And I didn't quite put you on the spot because it's not particularly controversial, but you weren't necessarily prepped to get all of that. But we talked last night, and as I said, I talked to the Principals Association principal from Northland, and some of the things we pointed out were some of the things you've said: full tummies, the better paid teachers, better home life. The only thing you didn't mention necessarily there that we ticked off on as well was smaller classrooms, and those seems to be the things that no political party, certainly National, doesn't ever want to address. They want to have a one size fits all result. They started it with national standards back in the day, and the principal I was talking to you last night was 100% convinced that this is the downstream effect from the national standards that National put in that they were warning them about, you know, a decade ago. I think the idea of nailing down to you must do this in this year is not how people operate. None of us operate that way. I don't know. It looks concerning to me. I'm dyslexic. I didn't find out I was dyslexic till I was 40. Kids like me who are in school, aren't the kinds of kids who are like, you need to do this test on this day in this way, or we're going to call it a fail. You know, it's just not, it's not the way it happens. And it seems National, and I'd be interested because you seem to be like this love child of ACT and the Greens, as you said, is that National has this policy, and I don't think it's a policy, sorry, they have this practice of trying to say, this is the singular answer, one size fits all. And often it's quite a harsh answer. So in this instance, it's like, test the kids twice a year. If they don't pass, it's going to be trouble. And it's the same for climate change. They talk about adapt. It's time to adapt. They're not talking about reducing. They're basically throwing their hands up and they're going, nothing we can do now. We're 0.whatever% of the world. We have to adapt. They seem to have this singular focus that probably is good on a bumper sticker and probably resonates with their base. You know, like, so for the school one, it's like, oh, these woke lefties teaching my kids about gender and stuff. Now let's get back to reading, writing, and arithmetic. So it'll probably work quite well with their base. I also think the climate change one probably works quite well with their base. It's like, yeah, let's start working forward. We don't need to look back. We don't need to change. Let's just work forward. And it seems to be the political football around this time of the cycle that the political parties in general come out with slogans, but National in particular seems to come out with, this is the answer. It's singular. And it's going to cause, like the schooling one, the brief bit that we've read and seen, it's going to cause many of the kids to fall through the gaps still. But they're also telling us this is the answer. And it frustrates me when political parties go singularly on something and they say this is the answer, when actually the climate change situation is, you know, adapt and reduce. You know, we can do both. We don't have to do just one. We can do, for the academic kids, more of a nationally standardized way of doing things, but let's say for the artistic kids that may not work, so we need to have something else. There doesn't necessarily need to be a one size fits all. That seems to be a trait of the right, saying we're one size fits all. And maybe the failing of the left is we will make 1,000 programs, one for every child, and perhaps somewhere in the middle is where we should be aiming to get to. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, and the fact is, the way technology is going is we probably will get to a more child-centered learning approach.
Because look, I've been involved in the education sector. I've got family. They've been saying that for a decade, 20, 30 years. When is that going to happen?
Well, here's the way I tend to approach it. And both my kids had learning issues, as I raised before. Yeah. One of them had dyspraxia. The other one had a sort of what I'd, I guess, numerical dyslexia.
So sorry to interrupt you, but to explain to people dyspraxia, a kid with dyspraxia is not going to learn to write in the allotted year that National says they should be able to write by. So that's a perfectly good example.
Yeah. And we had huge problems at school, and it was because we are, you know, we're very privileged, well-off people. We could put a lot of resources. It was like, you know, we did everything that we possibly could, including, you know, marching in and out of the school and saying the old way of teaching. And I think this is the teaching conversation of just standing at the blackboard and telling kids to do X, Y, and Z. My son also had, as part of dyspraxia, you know, he had very high sensitivity to noise. So he found the classroom environment a total nightmare. He found school a total nightmare. And I always used to say to him, oh, look, you know, you're not going to have a great time at school, but you'll have a great adulthood. And he has done. And he ended up doing like a million degrees, and he's teaching English in Japan. And he's one of the smartest kids you're ever likely to meet. And, and you know, the same with my younger one, who decided not to go to university because he was just totally put off by the education system. And actually, he's done some great things when he went overseas and traveled. And, you know, if we're trying to develop rounded human beings, then, you know, we have to take a different approach to the way we see the classroom. And of course, that's it's a bit like the health sector. I tend to go and talk to the doctors and the nurses and the porters and the care support workers to say, okay, what would you do differently? Because they're the people who actually do the work, and they tend to tell you, and you go, okay, that sounds sensible.
So that's same like talking, with teachers. The teachers. It's like talking to the teachers. That's the whole point. When national standards came out, and I don't know if you remember, every teacher was against it. Every teaching union was against it. They all said it wouldn't work, but it got pushed through anyway. And it's very interesting to hear some of the teachers talking about. The principal I talked to you last night said, because I said, Mr. Luxon is talking about going into all the schools. Has he been to your school? And he's like, yeah, it's interesting that because amongst the principals they talk, and he says many of them who have contacted Christopher Luxon's office and said, come to our school, he hasn't been to. But the safe ones in his area that he perhaps knows how they practice and knows there, he's been going to. So, yeah, I would often kind of delve back to saying, well, the expert to teach your six-year-old is probably the teacher of your six-year-old, not necessarily government in that moment to say how it should be done for everybody.
Yeah, and also, there were definitely used to be some old-fashioned approaches to teaching, but I want to sort of go back to the union thing. Yep. So I think one of the problem, and I sort of have experienced this myself, is you've had years of battles between the unions and, let's say, the capitalist class, you know, reflected through the ballot box. And obviously the Labour Party has been, you know, a strong part of the union movement. But again, because I sort of come to this with a different viewpoint, which is actually, I don't really care if you're in a union or if you're, you know, in the capitalist class. How do we solve the problem? But I think what I've noticed is there is so much distrust, and there's just so many legacy issues and so much baggage that, you know, in a way they're saying, right, we're having these national standards because essentially we don't trust the teachers, and they're all unionists and they all vote Labour and whatever. I kind of think, well, that's not the best way to approach this. And I'll give you an example of the level of suspicion. So when I was on a councillor, at Christchurch City, and dealing with a lot of our sort of assets and stuff, we owned a big chunk of the Littleton Port Company. It was listed on the stock exchange, but because we owned so much of it, there was no kind of market action. We owned like sort of 89% of it. So there was no point in it being listed. It was just a sort of a legacy thing. But what it meant is that it was very difficult for the council to say, we would like this to happen at the port, because obviously the CEO could say, oh, well, we're a listed company and I've got shareholders and directors' duties, etc. So we took it over. I did pretty much the whole thing. So I suggested, why don't we just take it over and delist it? Then we've got control of it, and then we can do what we want. So I did the takeover. We delisted it. It's in 100% ownership in the council. And then I said, then we can have conversations about what do we want our port to do? How do we want it to operate? And, you know, since that point, you know, and there were lots of safety issues, and there were people who had accidents at the port and were killed, and it was pretty poor. And the unions were very unhappy. They were quite militant. Yeah. And they were so suspicious of me. It was unbelievable, because they just thought, oh, this guy's kind of, you know, going to asset strip the thing or whatever. And we haven't. And things have improved hugely. And in fact, when I did the takeover, the first person I called was the union guy at the port. And I said, hey, just to let you know, we've just completed the takeover. And but there was so much distrust between the previous chief executive and the unions that it was like, oh, crikey. And, you know, that for me is part of the problem. So over safety has improved a lot. There's some great things going on down at the port. But it's like, how do we get through some of those old issues, which are real, you know, in terms of worker conditions, which I think are really important. And I went for a meeting one day, or it was a sort of a after work drink or whatever with, and the unions were there, and they kind of all looked at me like, oh, is he one of us? And is he? And it's like, no, I'm just a regular guy sitting down having a yarn. I don't see you as you're the terrible union, or you're the terrible this, that, or the other. And I think that that is probably a result of my background. I come from a very multicultural mixed background.
Right.
I've seen the damage that can happen when you get into identity issues and ethnic clashes. I've had it on both sides of my family, a lot of dispossession. And so I probably, you know, take a more relaxed view to labels and tend to just, I'm accepting of everyone, very liberal. I don't care what religion you like or who you sleep with or whatever. I tend to treat people as I find them and try and work out, okay, well, how do we solve the problem that we've got? And I see that as my role. So I see myself kind of as a facilitator in a way of trying to get people to the table and say, okay, let's stop arguing with each other and try and agree on the outcome. And if you can agree on the outcome, which is we want great educational outcomes for our kids, which frankly is not just about bloody passing exams, we know that. We actually want them to, the whole point of education, educare, you know, to lead them out into the world. How do we kind of, and yes, I did Latin at school, but, you know, how do we give our kids the type of essentially support through learning and doing so that when they kind of leave home, which these days is kind of never, they'll at least be able to go out into the world and make their own way.
Just so I'm clear, though, as well, you started talking about the unions. You gave us an example. It sounds like you were making a point about the teaching unions, because I brought up the teaching unions. What's the relation to the story you just told and the unions that I brought up in the situation of what, you know, national?
Yeah, no, I don't know the teaching unions. Yeah, I don't know the teaching unions at all. But it's my observation of the kind of
unions
the,
in general,
the conversation. You know, there's like, you know, you hear national complain, oh, but the teacher unions are kind of running the show, and I'm thinking, what is that about? So I wonder if it's because there are long-term legacy issues of distrust and conflict. And yeah, I mean, what happened to the schools in Christchurch after the earthquakes was appalling, you know, and that happened obviously under the national government, where they just came down and shut, you know, the Phillipstown school, and it's just terrible. And I think that was that's a classic example of the approach that national often takes, where they don't understand the role of community and the role of a school or a hospital or any other public service in the community. And of course, farmers will say the same about the role of farming in the rural community as well. So, you know, we've always got to remember there are people at the end of all these decisions. And if you're not talking to them before you make the decisions, you're going to have a problem.
You just said in that conversation around getting to the table and getting with unions that you're quite accepting of everyone. I did want to ask you about Posy Parker, because she's big in the news at the moment, coming to New Zealand to spread some of her quote unquote messages. Are you accepting of Posy Parker?
That's putting me on the spot there, because we had a bit of a Twitter drama on this a couple of days ago. I'll be frank, I didn't know who she was, because I've been deep in releasing this new policy over the last 4 or 5 days. And so I haven't been following the stuff. Look, it's, you know, after 15th of March, you know, like I said, I was very involved in the response. I had to deal with a lot of online stuff, NetSafe, police, hate speech. I've grown up, I've been attacked plenty of times for all kinds of reasons, not generally because nobody actually knows what my ethnicity is, so they just make up one to kind of suit themselves. I think, you know, we hate you because you're half Irish, half Indian. Well, how do you say that? Okay, so we'll call you something else. But anyway, look, we're in pretty distressing times. And I think I don't support this woman at all. I think the conversation around rights, and again, you know, I was Amnesty supporter from, you know, way back, is really critical to have a conversation and you know, to allow people's voices to be heard. The rise of the, and I said this about the parliamentary protests, when somebody said, oh, are you not going to kind of engage with this? I said, no, because I don't engage with anti-Semitism or anything to do with that. And, but yeah, do people have issues around mandate? Sure, but, you know, that's a different kind of issue. I think, you know, the Immigration New Zealand could have refused her entry based on simply what, the
what do you think? Would you personally have preferred to see her kept out, or would you support her coming in, and do you consider it a free speech issue? Where do you sit on that personally?
Look, I mean, I'm not scared of free speech, but I think the evidence from Australia, and like I said, I've not looked at everything, but there is definitely the possibility of public disorder. They had public disorder in Australia, and under Immigration New Zealand guidelines, they can refuse entry. Now, they might say that on balance, there was not enough evidence. Okay, fine. Hopefully there won't be public disorder.
Well, there's going to be. Not that you're being silly, but this is the point that we've been making in the last couple of days. I haven't even necessarily come to a position of she should be in or she should be out, but Immigration NZ has said that they don't believe that she is, quote, a threat or risk to the public order. And how you can not see those Melbourne protests and think there is if nothing else, a threat or a risk to the public order, if that's the benchmark, that all she needs to be is a threat or risk to public order, if they don't consider these two protests to be that, then nothing is. So it's not even disorder, it's to order, to public order.
I think if they had refused her entry, yes, there would have been a big outcry, but I think they would have been able to say, when you looked at the Nazi groups, neo-Nazi groups, whatever we call them these days, protesting outside the state parliament, you know, you've only got to look at Jan 6th in the US, you've only got to look at what we had here, and you'd say, no, sorry, say what you like, you've got this, the internet, you know, it's not like no one's stopping you talking, but there is a threat to public disorder. And I think if we're going to, I think the minister obviously has to come out and say, look, I kind of disagree with this, and actually, you know, he probably could overrule it, I don't know. But I imagine there's a lot of politics being talked about whether this is something that would be popular. But I think the fact is, if there is public disorder, then the decision will be shown to be wrong.
There's going to be. There's no way there's not going to be. We've already heard of the counter protest and that there's going to be public disorder. So here's a question for you, more based around, because we're here to talk about top as well, more based around top. Yeah. If this is our political compass again that we talked about, and you've put yourself certainly on the libertarian side of it, what is the top policy or position around sort of free speech versus hate speech? Obviously, the more libertarian someone goes, and you have it, and you put yourself, people listening to the audio podcast, maybe a third of the way down the chart. So there's a long way to go to being an absolutist libertarian.
Oh yeah,
more freedom. Where do you guys sit on a policy type issue or an ideological type issue of giving people as much free speech as they want versus drawing a line in hate speech? How does Top, not you personally, but Top approach that?
Yeah, look, I think that's a good question. And we've not, we have previous policies. I think we put up our old rainbow policy, you know, because we haven't got our policies on these issues are set for June and July, because they haven't been the front end of the focus. Again, with the 15th of March issue, I've been a little bit involved in that, and had spent time looking at, you know, essentially the five acts that can be relied upon to deal with hate speech and incitement to violence. And I've been through the process with NetSafe and with the police around this, and whether we should bring a criminal case against, you know, a person, et cetera, et cetera. And in the end, we decided not to. It's one of the issues around the current acts, and I think this was in the Royal Commission report, and this is why the community here is a bit disappointed, is that it's clear that the police is not prosecuting but the police could prosecute. So there are, you know, issues within the prosecution service. They are resourcing issues for the police, and that needs to be dealt with. For me, it's, yeah, there are people out there who, yeah, hold distasteful views. The incitement to violence is the critical one for me. And when I look at the Melbourne,
Melbourne followed by Hobart.
Yeah, the potential for violence is high. We've been through this parliamentary protest, and we have to find a way to have people allowed to talk about their particular rights, and then actually, okay, do those rights clash? And that's it. And can we then find a position where people's rights are met without, you know, denigrating the rights of someone else? I mean, so that those there are specialists who can deal with these rights conversations and the issues around women's rights, the issues around trans rights. We want everyone to be able to live their life, be who they want, be able to express themselves in their fullness. And if it's not harming anyone else, then, you know, there's nothing to worry about. And I don't think there is anything to worry about. But we have a right-wing fed conspiracy system, which, you know, started quite a while ago and percolates everything. And the worry for me around the upcoming election and the role of disinformation and misinformation is a huge issue, because you can't control it. Like I said, we had this thing on Twitter the other day about an ex-top guy who hadn't changed his profile, and we can't get him to change his profile because it's on Twitter, and Twitter has very limited help on that. With Facebook, we can do it because they've got a lot more support around that. And, you know, he liked some posts.
Yeah, are you saying that Elon's not returning your calls? Because he's running everything now, isn't he? Don't you just pick up the phone and Elon's sitting at the desk all the decisions? No?
There's no help desk. It's terrible. Like we have Facebook, and we have support for political parties and all that stuff. But it's like it kind of caused a bit of a furore, and it works both ways. All of us have to be quite careful when you kind of call people out for something. If it's not correct, you know, you take your post down, whatever. Because once stuff gets out there, it flies around the system like crazy. But I mean, I just want to go back, sorry, to answer your question because I waffled a bit in terms of the hate speech stuff. The government, like with all their policies, have done massive reverses everywhere. So we're left wondering what the hell is the Labour Party about or stand for. They should have sent it to the Law Commission at the beginning. It was the right place for the, it should have gone from the Royal Commission to the Law Commission. The Royal Commission made these recommendations that updates needed to be made to the various acts to deal with this, and the Law Commission should have dealt with it. So now Labour, having Kerry Allen having come out very bullishly last year and said, hate speech legislation is going to be through by next year, and everyone went, wow, okay. And, you know, and she's well liked, and people have high regard for her. And then obviously Hipkins has like got the handbrake on massively and rubber burning in the streets. So it's annoying, and it's upsetting for people who were having to pick up the pieces after the slaughter here in Christchurch and are still experiencing, you know, prejudice and hate speech and a sense of hate towards them. And it's really difficult because some people don't like it. But we have to say, if we have legislation and an offence has clearly been committed, the police have got to prosecute it. That's really the only way this is going to work.
Seems to be the sensible solution as well. If you break the law and get pulled over, if you're doing 100 in a 50 zone and you get pulled over by the cops, you should expect a ticket. You shouldn't expect a lot.
And then you can take it to the court. Courts decide. I mean, if we saw what happened with some of the government mandates, they went to court and the court ruled against the government. That's what the courts are there for. That's why the independent judiciary is so critical. The US is extremely compromised there. A lot of other countries are very compromised. New Zealand still has an independent judiciary that goes back to Parliament. If Parliament wants to change the law, they can change the law. Parliament is sovereign. And then the courts interpret it and say, do better or whatever. And we've got, you know, the global system is under a lot of stress and a lot of strain, and we need to hold firm on some of these issues, but we also need to do it in a way that is not inflammatory. And it's not easy, because I know people are very exercised and upset by a lot of stuff, but that feeds the beast, and the beast wants to be fed.
Yes, that's very true. Hey, just to wrap up with, I listened to a live stream that you did a few months ago. and you talked about sitting almost like no matter what, if you win Ireland, we haven't even talked about that, but your path to get into politics seems to be you winning a seat in Christchurch in Ireland, and then dragging in some more MPs with you if you get 3.5% or whatever that's going to end up being. Assuming you all do that, right? Well, I guess firstly, in 60 seconds, are you doing any polling in Ireland? Do you know how you're rating in Ireland? Are you likely to win Ireland? I mean, that's Jerry Brownlee territory, isn't it? Or it was.
Yeah, we're doing some research. We've done some research. I mean, for people who don't know Ireland, this will be my fourth election in 10 years here. So I've had two council elections here, which I won both times. The second time with 70% of the vote. I stood in 2017 in the general election against Gerry, essentially. Everyone thought I had no chance. I came second, so I beat Labour as well. Wow. as an independent.
Right.
And so this time, you know, I've got pretty good favourability and recognition here. A lot of people still don't know that I'm running, so we've got to do a little bit of work there. But I'm pretty confident that we're going to have a good show of it here. This seat's important for us. It's not that important for National or Labour. They need the party vote. That'll be their focus. And yes, I think if we can get our party vote up, and I think we will, as things go forward and people start to look for something a little bit different. I think we have a good story to tell. We've got some good candidates. And yeah, I could see us with maybe 2 to 4 MPs. And to answer your next question, you're going to ask me, we will go on the crossbenches.
So, yeah, no, this is my question now, because listening to that live stream, you said, if you get in, right, you're going to be an opposition party. Now, if I wanted to see a Labour-led government, or if I wanted to see a National-led government, doesn't that therefore mean a vote for top might hinder my party forming a government, because you're already guaranteeing you're going to be in opposition? So isn't it like, if I like your policies and I've enjoyed speaking to you and I hear you saying some of the same things that I've been saying, but if I know you're going into opposition and I want a Labour-Green-led government, for example, surely my vote for you is almost a protest vote. And if you're going into opposition, that might stop the party, the ideology I want to get into government. Why would I vote for you if that's going to be the case? I want to see my parties in power in decision-making situations. Why would I give a vote to top if you're already committing to being in opposition no matter what?
I would use the term proposition rather than opposition. Okay. So there's two scenarios. There's a scenario that National and ACT or Labour and the Greens, and of course the Māori Party is a tricky one because I think they've actually got the same approach as us, if they get either of those two blocks get 61 seats, then the conversation doesn't matter too much. Because they essentially are a majority government. What is likely to happen, and certainly all the polling shows, is that is not going to happen. It's going to be a very, very close election. And even if you take the average of the polls over the last 12 months, it's basically 59-56, with the Māori Party potentially with 3 or 4. Obviously, if I win Ireland, then maybe we have 2 or 3. My goal, we are not going to, in a way, interfere with who forms the government. That's a kind of key thing. Now, for a lot of people,
what if it's a hung parliament? What if it, like, there was an example? I don't like projecting seats. Like, I think that's I think that's a little bit deceptive of the pollsters. Because what the pollsters show is you can't project with pollsters. What you can do is show this is the snapshot of this week, what people were saying. But when they do project, there was an example this week where it was like, I think 59. One side at 59, one side at 56. They couldn't form it either way. They had to have I don't think this would ever happen, but it was National, ACT, and Māori Party would make 60. So they needed another one to form a government, or else it would be a hung parliament. What would happen in the situation if it's hung? What, you'd have a hung parliament?
Well, that's not actually how parliament works. I mean, I think you need 61 votes versus 59, but essentially you need a majority to pass legislation and to pass the budget. Now, our approach, given we're a small party and we are open to good policy. So we see our job as a kind of proposition party. So proposing good policy, but acting as a filter against bad policy. And clearly we would never support any policy that was not progressive. Now, in a way, it kind of doesn't matter who the government is, because to pass legislation, you need 61 votes. So if, let's just say, for example, National and Labour had 59 seats in their two blocks. And again, the Māori Party, I think are probably going to take a different perspective. They're not probably not going to go into coalition with Labour or the Greens, because I don't think they're going to be able to come to an agreement. So they will probably sit on the crossbenches too and just do it, detail by detail. So regardless of who the government is, you need 50, you need 61 votes to pass legislation. So our two votes, let's say two seats or three seats or whatever, can determine what legislation, policy and budgets get passed, but from either side of the fence. And I think that's the problem, is we're so used to essentially the governing party being the arbiter of everything, that we don't have examples, but it is possible, of legislation being passed by the other side of the house. Now, what the small parties have tended
but,
to do.
But hang on, what that means is, you say the government being the arbiter of everything, the example you've just given makes Top the arbiter of everything. Because of the example you've just given means that no one can pass anything without Top say so. That actually gives Top, two MPs, in the example you've given, all of the power to pass legislation. That doesn't feel like that's a better outcome.
Well, I mean, that's always been Winston Peters' view. I mean, Winston Peters essentially has always campaigned on the idea that he will hold the balance of power, which he has done. The difference, and he's always said, we'll go on the crossbenches and we'll go
and it's been terrible.
Policy.
And it's held up government ad nauseum.
But actually, he hasn't actually done that. He's always joined a government. He's taken his ministerial positions and whatever bits and pieces. And then you don't hear anything about
the word you're
again.
Looking, Rafe, I think the word you're looking for is he's taken the baubles of office. I believe those are the terms you're looking
for.
Yeah,
so we're not doing baubles. And also, I mean, to be practical, this will be our first time in Parliament. You know, we actually have to demonstrate our credibility and integrity about what we talk about. Our goal for, let's say, 2026 would be to get the threshold to 3% and try and get more MPs in. Then it might be a different conversation. So we don't see ourselves sitting there going, oh, we're not doing anything unless we agree with it. No, it's actually, we will certainly be there to stop bad policy, and we'll be certainly there, you know, it's not like we're going to have loads of people to be on top of everything.
But you appreciate as a voter, what you're saying is bad policy might be something that I want to see the left bloc or the right bloc put through. So again, it comes back to this example of you sitting across on the bench and voting and allowing both sides to pass policy means that actually Top, two MPs, and it won't be 61, because if you drag two or three people through and the Māori Party drag one or two people through, it's going to be 125 MPs. So maybe you need now 63, not 61, of which two people might end up making all of the decisions. One party made up of two people. So I love the concept, of us putting through the good ones and pulling back the bad ones. But that depends on who decides what's good and what's bad. So that's where, as a voter, I'm kind of going, would I rather have a big block through where I sort of know in general the ideology and where they're going to go? Do I trust one or two smaller parties to basically make all the decisions for what's going to happen in the next 3 years? That's a quandary. And that determines perhaps when some of us are going to put our vote towards a smaller party or a bigger block.
I mean, I'd answer that probably with two things. One is, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but most decisions are made by three people in the government. And I've experienced it firsthand. That's the way things work. And everyone else kind of scraps for leftovers and all the rest of it. That's the reality of politics. It's the big five or the big three or just one person, essentially. In terms of policies, I mean, what we're going to try and progress is the policies that we will go to the election with. So people can see quite clearly what our policies are. And a lot of people go, oh, geez, your policies are pretty radical. Or I have Labour people going, oh, geez, I wish the Labour Party would do this. And our policies are clearly very progressive, no doubt about that. And there's probably, are there things that the left would disagree with? Sometimes maybe the way we approach things. But yeah, I would say our policies are actually centre left. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Then why would you be centre right on the political compass? Why would you place yourself centre right on the political compass if your policies are centre left?
Well, I think I would actually place us, if you go back to your diagram, right underneath the Māori Party and probably similar to the Green Party on the libertarian thing. Actually, a lot of people, I think on the vote compass, people actually say we're quite close. People go, so many people say to me, oh, we did the vote compass thing and we came out with Top, but we didn't vote for Top, or we thought we were Labour, but we came out with Top. I don't know. Right. It's and I appreciate, this is MMP has to change. And I think we are part of the vanguard of that change. And I think, you know, when people look at our policies, they are progressive, they're liberal, in some cases a bit radical. The bit where the libertarianism comes in is, yeah, of course we want a universal basic income. I can guarantee you it's going to come. And we're trying to lay the pathway towards that, but we're also being realistic about what we can deliver in a first term. With you know, a small team, are we going to be looking at every bit of legislation? No, because we don't have the time to do that. But we will be the one party who can sit down and talk to people across Parliament. And hey, what about a grand coalition? I mean, I don't really care what party you're in. Are we going to get some decent policy? So if you're, let's say you're on the left, you might see us actually as the insurance. We are the insurance play that actually, whatever happens, we want top in Parliament, because if we cannot form a government on the left, they're our only hope of stopping bad legislation coming through. So we're an insurance ticket. I mean, that's one way to look at it. So if you're worried about, you know, ACT, if you're worried about ACT, which a lot of people I know are on the left, well, we're not going to do half the stuff that they're promoting. But if we want to do things, do we support things like, you know, a carbon tax and dividend, or GST back on building consents? So from the economic financial stuff, we might go, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense. You know, that's a different conversation. But if they're saying get rid of all these ministries and we don't do, you know, we're not going to talk the Māori, or we're not going to recognize interest in wars, well, we'd say, well, we don't agree with that. See ya. And
I would be a little bit careful if you're going to try and attract some left-hand voters to say we're not going to do half of what the ACT Party wants to do, you know, because most people would go, well, if you're going to do half of it, then that's enough for me. I'm not interested. But I hear what you're saying. Look, this has been a fascinating chat. And I think probably what we need to do, Raph, if you're up for it, is have a chat again closer to the election when some more policies and stuff have come out. We'd like to do that. Maybe what we'll do as well is in our nightly live stream show, get you on there. And you can just have a chat directly to some punters, and they can ask you some direct questions, and we can do that if you're up for that between now and the end of the year. What do you want to leave us with? Let me show people how they can get a hold of you guys and find out more about TOP. It's just top.org.nz, pretty easy to find there. What do you want to leave us with? What do you want us to know? What's your business card exit?
Yeah, we want a fairer society for all. It's as simple as that. We have got some extreme challenges coming our way with climate change. There are huge financial and economic issues. There are technological drivers which are going to change the way that we live. And we have to get ahead of that stuff. And I think we're wasting time. You talked about climate adaptation. Yes, but actually the more we reduce emissions, the less adaptation we have to do. We're trying to produce some policies that are accessible for people so that they can understand them, because that's really critical. And I think one of our issues in the past is being a bit too nerdy. So we try to simplify things. But, you know, we want a kind of just society. We want our kids to be safe and grow up in safe homes and communities and have the things they need to grow up and face the world. I can't do much about what's coming globally, but we can certainly put our foot forward and try and, you know, rediscover a sense of what, you know, New Zealand was supposed to be about and hasn't quite delivered. And that's a country that does provide opportunities for all.
I think you should embrace the nerd, because I think of that old saying, was it Bill Gates who said it? Be nice to the nerds, they'll end up being your bosses. I think it's okay to think about be nice to the nerds, they'll end up writing policy. I would much rather a nerd wrote a policy than some doofus who didn't know half of what's going on. So I would say embrace the nerd. But yeah, we'd love to have you back on BHN, and we'll get you on for a live stream if you're up for it, and we'll you know, let the punters have a crack at you and get some questions as well, because it's been really insightful. I think for me, this is what I get from this conversation, Raph, is that the more I know about you guys, the more I know what your policies are, the more ability I'll have to trust what you consider to be good policy and bad policy, because I don't know right now. The flip side to that is sometimes when I'm thinking about political parties, it's not necessarily the policies they release. It's, for example, if something happens in the middle of their term that's an unknown quantity. I don't know. Let's say two cyclones in a row going through Auckland and wiping out a whole bunch of people. There's no policy for that. But if I understand their ideology, and I understand where they sit on and those sorts of issues, I can then trust that in that moment that we don't know about, they'll make good policy decisions. So there's a couple of learning things there for all of us, me included, and that's the responsibility of you guys to let us know about. And then when we do, then we'll be able to make an informed decision. And I guess we can't ask for anything more than that, can we?
No, I mean, and that is actually a very good way to think about it, is I often say to people, you know, and this is the relatability around leaders, is actually, do you think they will do the right thing?
Yeah.
When the challenge comes. Like I say, the bog standard day in and day out policy, yes, we can all get better at that, we know. But can they be relied upon to do the right thing when the S hits the fan? Which it will do. It happens to every government.
You can say shit on this podcast, is all right.
Okay. When the shit hits the fan, yeah. I mean, I've been through earthquakes, fires, floods, terror attacks. I've been airlifted out of a war zone. I've experienced a lot of that, and probably crisis management is probably one of my kind of skill sets. It's going to happen, and we need good people around who you can rely on to actually do the right thing, which is actually, how do we look after people after a disaster? It's as simple as that.
Definitely. Raf Manji, leader of the Top Party, top.org.nz. Thank you for joining us today, and look forward to talking again before the election.
Okay. Thanks for having me. Cheers.